Hadi bakalım.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Human Reaction, your weekly source for independent commentary on cultural news and politics, where it's always our mission to arm you with the tools you need to cut through media misdirection and resist the mononarrative. We're glad to be back here with you. I've got my esteemed co-host David Rand with me for once these days, looking very dapper, by the way.
Straight from the Capitol.
How are things going up there?
It's interesting. We'll dig into it. We'll talk about it today.
Good. Yeah. Well, what are we talking about today?
Well, tonight we're joined by Dan McKnight. He's the founder and CEO of Bring Our Troops Home. And we're going to talk about constitutional war powers, returning them to their proper place, and growing a grassroots movement to end endless wars. So, Dan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here. A little bit of a travel from Eagle, Idaho to Bozeman, but I love it. Your guys' airport, by the way, stunning. Stunning airport. Beautiful. Yeah.
It's one of the nicest ski lodges in the state,
I think. It is the nicest ski lodge I've ever been to. Yeah.
I'm going to do the Joe Rogan thing, although I'm the poor man's Joe Rogan. A little tighter. Just get up,
gotcha,
in there.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Move it where you need it. Yeah, move it where you need it, too. Don't worry about it.
There we go.
There it is.
With like dark phallic symbols all near my mouth. Sorry. Are we into this thing already?
Yeah, it started now.
Yeah.
Friends, We're not doing it again.
It is going to be that kind of episode, so maybe put the kids to bed and then watch this episode.
All right, if it's that kind of episode, can you unmute Stream Deck then?
Oh, is it muted?
Oh, yeah.
Try it now.
Just censoring Bennett over here.
I'm not meaning to.
Didn't even introduce him either. We just kept him in the corner.
That's fine.
Where he belongs.
So, Dan.
Yes.
You served in the military. You saw firsthand how the National Guard troops are being deployed overseas. What inspired you to start Bring Our Troops Home?
Well, I'll give a little bit of backstory. I was in the Marine Corps in the 90s, and then the active duty Army, I transferred after Bill Clinton tried to defund the Marine Corps. I transferred to the Army and served a tour there. Came home, went to Boise State University, started my college career, and then we got attacked on 9/11. And on September 12th, I went down and joined the Idaho Army National Guard as part of the Apache Helicopter Battalion because I wanted to go to Afghanistan to avenge America, right? Mm-hmm. We'd been unjustly attacked, and I wanted to go win the war. I was young and dumb and full of testosterone.
Is that how that goes?
Yes.
Yeah, that's the same. That's the same. I know that's
the same. That's what I thought. That's what I thought.
Yeah. And, no. And so in 2005, we got deployed, not to Afghanistan or Iraq, but to Hurricane Katrina. Because the Louisiana National Guard, who are a brigade of combat engineers that specialize in building roads and bridges and dams and levees, were gone from Louisiana and they were in Iraq building roads and bridges and levees and dams. So when Katrina hit, all 50 states plus four territories sent the National Guard from their states to Louisiana to provide aid, comfort, fish dead people out of the roads, all kinds of stuff. Mm. And on the way back, I led a convoy from Idaho to Louisiana. On the way back, they had us drop our trucks off at Fort Hood, Texas, and they exchanged the vehicles for orders to Afghanistan. And we just basically traded. And I went from Louisiana to Fort Hood to Afghanistan. I was gone for 18 months. And when I was there, we were part of the largest offensive operation in Afghanistan war history. It's called Operation Mountain Lion. And we were National Guardsmen, but we were attached to the 10th Mountain Division and the 82nd Airborne Division. So we were kind of a novel concept, the National Guard participating as an expeditionary force in war. And none of them wanted us. They thought we were all part-time soldiers, weekend warriors. But we were incredibly well-trained, very proficient. Our equipment was top-notch. But my guys, I had a team of 12 National Guardsmen from Wisconsin that I was in charge of. And we would go out to these far remote places in northeastern Afghanistan, right by the Pakistan border, and put up these remote called forward operating bases where we would receive the Apache helicopters. The Blackhawks would come in. They'd drop off bodies. They'd pick up ammunition, fuel, go back and fight the war. And after about 60 days of this, my guys' uniforms were worn out. Boots were destroyed. Mm-hmm. Body armor was gone. We couldn't get gloves and goggles. And I got frustrated because 10th Mountain wouldn't help us. 82nd Airborne wouldn't help us. My own chain of command wouldn't help us get supplies. And so I got pissed off. And I grabbed a satellite phone, and I climbed to the top of this mountain and got a clear signal. I wanted the best signal I can get on that satellite phone, and I called the governor of Idaho. Why not, right? Hmm. And I said, Governor, you're the commander-in-chief of the National Guard. I'm one of your troops in Afghanistan, and we need help. And Governor Risch said, well, Dan, I've been the governor for a minute. I was just appointed governor because our governor went to D.C. to work in the administration. Hmm. He goes, but I understand the Constitution. I understand I'm the commander-in-chief when you guys are home. I'm probably not in your chain of command now, but you're still my soldiers. I'm going to do something. So I hung up the phone, walked back down to the base, went back to work. And the next day, my battalion commander essentially kicked my door open and said, I don't know who you called. I don't know what you did, but you've overstepped the chain of command. But there's a shipping container on its way from Idaho with all the supplies that you need. Now give me your goddamn cell phone. Sorry. And he got pissed, took away the satellite phone. And because officers don't like that, they don't like, they like being able to report that they did something good, right? And he wasn't able to report that he had successfully gotten his troops supplies. So I held Governor Risch in really high esteem. I mean, in my life at that time, there was Ronald Reagan, there was Jim Risch. Those were my two guys. And I guess if you really want to get down to the nuts and bolts of it, Charlton Heston was also on that. You know, because who doesn't love Moses with a gun?
Yeah.
And but the rest of the war went on. I got hurt in Afghanistan. I came home after 13 years, and they let me go because I was injured. But while we were there for 18 months, we changed our purpose and our mission 8 different times. We got there, and it was shock and awe. Remember the shock and awe?
Oh, yeah.
We're going to bomb the hell out of them, and we're going to make them go, oh, my God, America's here. Turn over all the bad guys. And then we went after – we did that for a few months. Then we went into provincial reconstruction, where we went back and built roads and schools and water treatment facilities. And then we turned those over to the Taliban as part of this peace resolution to try and get Taliban back on our sides. So we build a school, then we give it to the Taliban to use as a command center. And then we got into counterinsurgency. And then we got into winning hearts and minds. And all these different strategies kept changing, but nobody was ever held accountable. So I came home thinking, what the hell did we just do there? Why was I gone from my family? Half my battalion was there taking college classes. Half of us were out in the sticks fighting the war. And I don't want to misrepresent myself. I wasn't a door kicker or anything like that. I never went out and raided villages and did that stuff. But we were fighting the war. And I got home and I was pissed and I went underground. I was angry. I couldn't get treatment from the VA. I grew a long beard. It was down to my waist almost. Got real heavy. I was a little over 300 pounds. Whoa. Just pissed off and angry. Lost my home. Lost my wife. Lost my family. Lost a business that I'd grown before I left. And I was pissed off at my government. And over the next few years, some of my best friends that were still in the Guard were going back for their 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th combat tours as National Guardsmen. And in 2015, this gold guy, orange man, excuse me, comes down this gold escalator and he starts talking about these stupid wars. And I'm like, oh, we might have something here. Someone's speaking to my soul. It wasn't since Ron Paul in 2012 that I had felt like somebody actually cared. And I didn't know if he cared or not, but transactionally, he was saying the right things. So I paid attention. I watched him over the next couple of years. And in 2019, the Republicans retook control of the Senate. And the chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations was Governor Jim Risch now. He was now Senator Jim Risch. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to see if I can reach out to him again and see if he'll do something in his position of authority to just find a way to end these wars. They're dumb. We don't have a purpose being there. But I didn't have his number anymore. And so I did what every good Marine did. I got my box of crayons out, right? And I sharpened up the purple one because purple's pretty, right? See the background here. And I wrote an op-ed to Senator Risch. And 9 newspapers in my state picked it up and ran it. And he came to town about a week later, and I went to the event where he was speaking, and I took a friend of mine with a camera, and I said, hey, I'm going to ask him a question. And when I ask him a question, turn the camera on. That's about as basic as Marines can get in their commands, right? Me stand, you film, you know? And so Jim Risch was there, and I stood up, and I said, hey, Senator Risch, my name is Dan McKnight. And he stopped me right there in front of this crowd of, I don't know, 2,000 people. He goes, Dan, I remember you from 2005. I remember helping you get supplies. I read your op-ed. I agree. I'm the chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and we're done nation building. He turned 30 years of American foreign policy upside down on its head right there in Boise, Idaho. Wow. And I thought, my God, this is easy. 2 for 2.
And, you're nailing it, dude.
It's so easy. And so I great, thanks. And he got on a plane and went back to Washington, D.C., and 3 times over the next 90 days voted to extend the wars indefinitely in Afghanistan, Yemen, and Iraq. And so I thought, all right, I'm a Marine. I'm going to run through walls. That's what we do. So I raised a little bit of money, and I found 100 of my friends that I've been deployed with. And I said, I'm buying you a ticket. We're going to Washington, D.C. How good of an idea is this, right? So 100 of us stormed Washington, D.C. Maybe insurrection 1.0. I don't know. But we scheduled properly meetings with all of our senators and congressmen, and we were just going to sit down and go make a plea for peace. Hey, give it a shot. Let's try this thing. We're going to tell you our stories. We're going to tell you why we think it's important. And every one of them did the same thing. They gave us the platitudes. We support the troops. You know, we're there for the troops. We'll always be there for the troops. They put their arms around us, took a picture, had a yellow ribbon on their door, and then politely walked us out the room without giving us any commitment of doing anything, except for one. One of them told us the truth. And bless her heart, Liz Cheney looked us dead in the eye, and she says, as long as I'm in this seat, we're never coming home from Afghanistan.
She said that?
To our face.
Wow.
Yeah. That's insane.
So we went to
I
Wyoming.
I believe it. There it fits the character.
The only thing unbelievable about this story so far is that I wrote something, right? I mean, so we went to Wyoming, and I said, we have two missions now. We have to find better ground to fight on. We can't fight in the swamps of Washington, D.C., and we have to destroy Liz Cheney.
Absolutely.
So we went to Wyoming and went to every single county and coordinated with the Republican Party in Wyoming and had them censure her in every single county except for one in Wyoming and stripped her of all institutional support from the Republican Party for her reelection, all funds, all door knockers, everything. Mm. And then we started working with Harriet Hageman, who replaced her, and helped her win. We started going to events with her, speaking with her, helping her with her messaging. And we beat that heiress of a war profiteer fortune, the apple of her daddy's eye, Liz Cheney. We beat her by 40 points.
Yeah.
Wow. Destroyed her.
Yeah.
And that's my biggest feather in my cap. It's one of my most proud moments. But what we
Can
did-
Can I just say thank you?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Serving America with that one, brother.
You really did us all a solid with that one.
Thank you. I think we did. I do flinch when I see a helicopter now and then because I'm sure Dick is up there. And I don't go bird hunting anymore either because I don't want to get blasted in the face. But
he's hiding in the bushes somewhere.
You know he is. That's kind of a double entendre there.
Hiding in the bushes.
Dick in a bush. And but while we were fighting Liz, we realized we can't fight in D.C. I would rather fight in Cheyenne or Helena or Boise or Phoenix because it's much more hospitable ground. My lever's longer. I know my state representatives better than I know my senators, my congressmen. And so we started looking for a way to fight this fight locally. And we found Pat McGeehan, a delegate from West Virginia, Air Force Academy graduate, global war on terror veteran, who had been pushing the defend the guard concept in West Virginia for 5 years. Never even gotten a hearing. It never gone anywhere. There hadn't been a floor debate. No motion whatsoever. And we read the bill. We fine-tuned it with the 10th Amendment Center. If you guys know them, they're fantastic. Mike and Harry's awesome. Yeah. And really refined the bill and said, hey, we're going to take the lead on this thing. Look out. And we started running from there. And in 5 years, we've got the bill in over 30 states introduced. We've got it on the ballot in Texas. It was on the 2024 primary ballot this year, where it received 83% of the Republican voter support. We beat Donald Trump in Texas.
Wow.
Who can say that?
Hell yeah.
We beat him by 80,000 votes. And the best part about it is the number of no votes on Defend the Guard was almost identical to the number of people that voted for Nikki Haley. Almost identical.
Whoa.
Look at that.
Causation, correlation, I don't know what it was. But
also checks out.
It does check out. Again, still the writing with the crayons is the most unbelievable thing of this story. We've gotten 6 or 7 states to adopt Defend the Guard as their on their state Republican Party platform as a plank, including Montana. Mm-hmm. It's done in Montana. And like I said, we're in 30 states. We've passed the Montana was the first committee we ever passed. It was 2 years ago with Representative Lee Deming. We passed in the committee to push it out to the floor. And then we won in Arizona, the Senate twice, two times. It'll be three times next week. We've passed the Idaho Senate, the New Hampshire House of Representatives. The Virginia House of Delegates just passed 99-0 unanimous support. And we think this year we're going to get it on the governor's desk in probably 2 states and maybe even get it signed in one of those states. And we are changing war powers at the state level. And the way we do it is by saying that the state National Guard cannot be taken into federal service if the purpose is to go overseas to fight a war that has not been declared by Congress. And so to make that easy, we say before we put our boots on the ground, Congress has to put their name on the line. That's the whole concept. And with that, good night.
No, we're not done with you yet.
That's amazing. I mean, I just want to ask really quick, which you said you might get it through in 1 or 2. Which ones do you think are the most likely at this point?
Arizona and Idaho.
Yep. Not Montana, huh?
Well, we'll see tomorrow.
It's a rough road, but we'll see tomorrow. Yeah, we got a hearing tomorrow. We got a pathway, but it's a narrow one. So we're working our best.
So you're saying there's a chance.
There's a chance. We're working it.
Well, hey, this guy runs through walls, so I feel like he could probably work with a narrow doorway.
That's right.
Yeah, so in talking about your experience in the military, after 9/11, it was very clear we were going to war, right? I mean, deploying to Afghanistan, there was a broad national understanding of that. When you walked around the streets of where I was at the time, Helena, flags everywhere. People understood it. Yep. There was a debate about how we're going to pay for this, at least, you know, things like that. I mean, we didn't pay for it, but there was a debate. thanks, Bush. So what's it like with so many troops that are still deployed? there's still National Guard troops all over the world in forward operating bases across the Middle East and all kinds of places. Not, this isn't Okinawa, Japan, right? This isn't Germany. This is in real places of war right now. But there's none of that social understanding of their deployment. What's that like for those troops?
I'll tell you, in World War II, this was the peak of military might in the United States. About 11% of the population served in the military at that time. Today, it's less than one half of 1%. So 99.5% don't have any direct tie to the human cost of war at all. And so they think that Veterans Day is a time for veterans to go to Applebee's and get free fajitas. That's what they think of for Veterans Day. Or we put a flag out in our yard. But what's going on is there's veterans that are being put into combat situations without any declaration of war or without the informed consent of the American people. And you look all across the Horn of Africa, the Middle East, Europe, the South Pacific, and the National Guard was deployed to over 100 countries in the last 24 months, 100 countries. And in 17 of those, they were involved in direct conflict and in exchanging of bullets, right? We call that war. Congress doesn't call it war. They call it policing activities or peacekeeping. But if you've had that snap of a bullet go over your head and you've returned fire, you know what war is, right? What does the Supreme Court say about pornography? You'll know it when you see it, right? That's the same thing about war. And so 17 nations, they've been directly engaged in war. The Florida National Guard was in Ukraine with the Ukrainian army when the war with Russia kicked off, right? When the Syrian civil war kicked off, 3% of the American troops that went into the country illegally, by the way, because Obama asked for permission to go and Congress told him no, and he gave him the double burden, went anyway. And 3% of the troops on the ground were from the National Guard. And when al-Assad regime fell in December, 58% of the boots on the ground were from the National Guard. Nobody knows this. Nobody's talking about it. And the National Guard is finding themselves on two of the three sides of that war in Syria. We were fighting on one side. We were funding another side. And we were cheering, hopefully, that the third side would fall. It was a horrible love triangle. And the people right in the middle of it, South Carolina National Guard, Montana National Guard, Tennessee National Guard. And it's just, it's not the way it's supposed to be. The National Guard was never meant to be an expeditionary force for wars of choice overseas. They're meant to be for the defense of America. For the defense, and then to backfill and augment the active duty military when properly authorized by Congress. And so I would say for the guardsmen, we feel, I know I did when I served, we feel under-recognized, right? Because people think the National Guard is 1 week in a month and 2 weeks in the summer, right? We've all seen the commercials. It's a flat-out lie, right? It's a lie. Right now, the National Guard is on an every three-year rotation. One out of every 3 years, you are likely to deploy overseas outside of the continental United States for something other than training. And that's just not the way it's supposed to be. So it's a de facto backdoor draft. And the way it's been used by politicians is disgusting.
With the advent of the most recent Trump administration and sort of the rhetoric that he ran on, the campaign promises, the talk of ending the wars, do you feel like the national attitude around these conflicts that we're waging all over the world has shifted from the first administration, the first Trump administration? Do you think it's a more fertile groundwork for this sort of thing to achieve more popular support?
I think fertile groundwork is probably actually a pretty good description. But in his first term, there were some powerful polls that were put out because he was the only president ever, and since World War II, ever to run on an anti-war platform as a major party candidate. He's the only one. And there was 76% of the military in 2018 were polled, 76% that the war in Afghanistan wasn't worth it. 76% of the members of the military. So. Wow. That was the concept at the time. People were thinking it, but there was no outlet for that. There was no news outlet was going to tell that story.
Yeah.
Because, if it bleeds, it leads. And so they like the stories of death and heroism and all the things that go with the military, the Call of Duty generation. And so I think that the ground has become tilled. And I think those seeds that were planted are starting to bear fruit. And that's what's happening. I don't think it's a change of position. I think it's a change of the environment.
Yeah.
And I think the message is better received now.
One of the things you brought up, the kind of the purpose of the Guard. And one of the things I've noticed as I've lobbied legislators is it seems to me that most operate on an assumption that the National Guard is kind of like the Army Reserve too, right? It's just like another reserve army. None of its statutory status, none of its relationship with the governor and Title 32 and none of that stuff, or in Title 10, none of that stuff really comes to the surface for most people. Their mental model as it sits with the National Guard is just another branch of the military. So can you kind of lay out the history of the National Guard and like its founding and its kind of status that makes it different from other branches?
Sure, I'll do it. I'm gonna advise anybody that's sleepy at this moment and driving, go ahead and pull over because this is going to put you to sleep.
We love history around here. It's good.
The National Guard today is, they have evolved from the militia, right? The militia. The founding fathers did not want a standing army. They wanted to spread the gunpowder around. They wanted to decentralize the power of a military. And so every state has a militia, and it's built into the Constitution. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 says that the states will have these militias, this ready reserve that they can call forward for three purposes. The federal government can call the militia from the state into federal service for three purposes: to repel an invasion, to put down an insurrection, and to enforce the laws of the Union. That's it. That's it. That's the whole thing. And so the National Guard over time has found themselves in different complexities where they're called forth to enforce laws or defend the borders. And so over time, the law has evolved. And in 1903, the Dick Act defined the National Guard as the militia, or the militia as the National Guard. It made that final distinction that says the militia, the ready reserve of the state, is now the ready reserve of the Army and the Air Force. Not the Air Force at the time. They wouldn't have been very good. And so in 1915 or 16, they modernized the Defense Act, and they made the National Guard. They standardized training across the country and said that the National Guard had to follow certain standards of administration, of training, of rank structure, so that if the Massachusetts National Guard and the Virginia National Guard ended up activated together, they could mesh. They understood the same training, the same tactics. And then in 1933, they modernized it one more time, and I can't remember the name of the bill, but it defined the dual role of the militia now. The militia now, when you signed up for the National Guard, you were going to take two oaths, one to your state and one to the National Guard of the United States. Both of them swore allegiance to the Constitution, though, so that's the commonality. But one is just saying that you would follow and obey direct orders from the federal government, from the president, one from the governor. And so the National Guard, or the militia, I'm going to call them both, I'll just interchange the words, serves two purposes. First and foremost, they are primarily the defense force of the state to deal with defense of their state, of their citizens, of their property, and to ensure a Republican form of government and to aid in times of national emergencies or state emergencies. Now, the federal government, though, they can call them forward, like I said, for those three purposes we talked about. And when they do that, they stay on Title 32 orders. And this is where it's going to get really nuanced. Title 32 means they're funded by the federal government, but they're maintained control by the state. So the federal government's going to pay them for equipment, training, salaries, all the stuff, but the governor will still maintain control. But once in a while, in rare and limited circumstances, the National Guard has to be called as the ready reserve of the Army and the Air Force. And when they do that, they transfer them to Title 10 for five specific purposes: to participate in war that's been declared by Congress, to participate in annual training, to participate in engaged prolonged training, and then limited capacity for a presidential declaration of emergency, and then one other situation that's very minor. Oh, if you're captured as a POW, they can keep you on active duty orders until you come home. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right. And so nowhere in that Title 10 transfer does it say that the National Guard can go be the foreign policy bitches of the president. It doesn't say that, but that's what they've become. And it started with Bush. Bush was the first one to activate the National Guard to backfill all the positions in the United States where the active duty army was gone in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they backfilled the National Guard to Fort Campbell, Fort Stewart, Fort Lee, all these different places. And then President Bush looked down there and he saw all these able-bodied men. He thought, think of all the other wars we could have. And he goes, they're already on Title 10. I'm just going to convert them and send them. They're now active duty military. I can do what I want with them. Mm-hmm. And there was, you guys are too young to remember this probably, but there was court case after court case after court case. States were suing the federal government. Bush can't do that. He can't do this. He can't do it. But the Supreme Court kept coming back and be like, he can, because they were federalized legally for a proper purpose. And once they're federalized, they're active duty army. They don't fall under the governor's purview anymore. So that's what Defend the Guard is. We're trying to put that check in place that says before you take them from the state to the federal government, it has to be for one of the defined purposes. It can't be for anything shady. And that's all Defend the Guard is. And so that's the evolution of the National Guard over time, from militia to modern day warfighters.
So really, in the process of fighting for Defend the Guard passage in all these states, you're up against the military industrial complex and the executive branch and a lot of powerful forces. What does that path look like? Who are you up against, and how are you looking at that?
If I were to put them in ranking order, it'd be Satan. He's number one. No, the National Guard Bureau hates this bill. Every time we show up in a state legislative hearing, in a committee or on the floor, a one or two star general shows up, and it's usually me against him every time. And they show up in the stars on the collars and the ribbons on their chest, and I show up hopefully with a fresh haircut. And they argue that the state's going to lose all this funding if Defend the Guard passes, and you're going to lose all your tanks, your helicopters, your airplanes, all the salaries, everything, because the federal government, if they can't abuse your troops the way they want, why would they pay for them? So that's the biggest argument.
Well, I have a question on that one, because you said when you were in, it was Iraq, correct?
Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, I apologize. You didn't have the gear that you needed.
Right.
So what funding are we talking about here exactly?
That's a great question. Salaries, compensation, pay, benefits, equipment, all of it. Just because we couldn't get it doesn't mean it didn't exist somewhere, right? This is their argument. Oh, it was early in the war. Logistics takes time to catch up with reality. Oh, okay. Well, anyway, the trucks we were driving, the planes we were flying, the helicopters we were flying, the bombs we were dropping, all of that's paid for by the federal government. Now, here's the thing. The federal government is obligated to fund a state National Guard. They're obligated because they've created these laws that say that the states have to maintain certain training and administrative standards so that if they get called forward, they're already trained. They wouldn't want us to train with a broomstick and pretend that we were flying around and then go to active duty and they give us a helicopter. Mm-hmm. So they have to give us the equipment to train on so that when we get called forward, we're properly trained and we can integrate. And so the argument that they would take away our funds is based on Title 32. They say there's actually something in the law that says the president can take away your funds for the National Guard if you don't comply with three things: proper administration, readiness training, and force structure.
Yeah,
you have to have, right? And so if you don't qualify for those three things, they can take your funds away eventually after a retraining period and a warning period. But it doesn't say they can take your funds away if you refuse, if the governor interposes and says you're not sending our troops to Syria because there's no authorization. Those are two different things. That's Title 10. Funding is Title 32. And so they try to conflate the two because it's very confusing. It's easy to confuse. Mm. And the law, if you read it in pieces, you can make that argument. But if you read it in whole, there's a legal canon that says in order to understand a law, you have to read all of the law. And if you read it all, it's crystal clear. What they're doing is a direct violation, and threatening to take away money is coercion from the federal government. It's blackmail. They're bribing us with our own tax dollars. We can call whatever we want, but in short, it's illegal. So the National Guard Bureau is not they're not an elected body. They are not a constitutionally created body. They're a professional lobbying organization. They exist for one purpose: to get more missions, more money, more equipment for the National Guard. Mm. And we saw them in Tennessee this week at the National Guard Association convention, paid for by Northrop Grumman and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Also checks out.
Also, it does check
definitely
out.
Checks out.
And they were there teaching generals and their colonels and all their staff how to fight Defend the Guard. They were
really,
we've got the receipts, right?
Whoa.
So they were teaching their generals how to fight our bill, and they were doing it with just conjecture and lies. And then we see what we were doing in Montana, and I'll let you tell that story, but it's disgusting what the general's doing up here other than the thinly veiled threats and testifying in uniform, which by the way is a violation of Department of Defense Directive 1344-10 for those of you keeping score at home.
Okay, so I thought so. It's not expressly like illegal per se, but it's against some sort of regulation.
Yeah, a kid got in big trouble for it back in the Ron Paul days, back in like 2008, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
But is it sort of a, well, I have the authority as a general, so I'm just going to skate on that?
Well,
or?
Here's the thing. The only person that is allowed to testify in uniform is the adjutant general of the National Guard. Only one in each state. A state law, federal law, they dismiss that law for the adjutant general. So him showing up in uniform, or her, for those states that care about winning wars. Did I say that out loud? Sorry. That it.
Just jokes.
The general showing up is actually a proper role of his job, but he's there. He's supposed to be there as a neutral advisor. Mm. He's supposed to be there to say, if Defend the Guard passes, this is how we would have to apply the law. That's his job. It's not to speculate. It's not to offer his own opinion. It's not to offer conjecture or thinly veiled threats or anything. His job is to be there as an advisor, a neutral advisor, and not to say, hey, if this bill passes, we could lose money. His job is to say, hey, if this bill passes, this is how we would have to administer it, mm-hmm. period. But when he shows up with his chief of staff or his JAG or his command sergeant major. Now he is inducing them to violate Department of Defense orders, and they are violating them themselves. So their defense is, I'm just following the order of my general. The general doesn't have that kind of innocence. He is culpable of inducing them to break the regulations.
Okay, so with Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense, who has been very supportive of Defend the Guard, from my understanding, do you have some sort of backstop against that, do you think, with DOD in that way?
Yes, but I'm going to be very cautious of this. Pete has endorsed the bill. We've all seen the clip of him on Fox News talking about, I love this bill, after New Hampshire passed it through the House. He's a National Guard officer. He gets it. He's very principled. If you've read his book, War on Warriors, he is about constitutional and proper war powers. And so when he supported it last January after New Hampshire passed the House, we started reaching out and contacting him and trying to get him to support it more. And then, lo and behold, he gets nominated for Secretary of Defense. And all of our work paid off. I was invited to a private dinner with him in West Palm Beach, Florida in December, where I got to sit down and talk to him at length about Defend the Guard. Mm-hmm. He loves the bill. And he asked at that moment in time, and I'm kicking myself now for not taking him up on it. He asked what he could do to help. And we were so worried about him getting nominated. I said, you have a mission right now. Get nominated. Once you're nominated, we'll circle back. I Jen Psaki'd him. We'll circle back. And since he got, and then we went to bat for him, and we started calling Mitch McConnell's office and Lindsey Graham's office and Jim Cornyn's office and really flooding the phones trying to get him confirmed. And once he was confirmed, he hit the ground running. He is the most impossible man to get a hold of now. He was in Japan with a friend of ours who's our contact in his office, one of his schedulers, and he left Japan and came straight home because he realized right now, I can't wait any longer. I have to fire about 100 generals. So he's coming home to drop the hatchet. Wow. And so we can press him so hard. But now that we've mentioned that Pete Hegseth endorses the bill, the great Diego Rivera, he's our director of field operations. He's the one that leads all of our ground efforts. He says, you give a legislator that, it's like giving a mouse a cookie. Now they want two cookies. Now they don't want the letter or they don't want his words. They want a letter, a direct letter from Pete Hegseth to me. Yeah. Oh, you're that important. I'm sorry. I didn't realize. Sorry. And so and then if we got them the letter, then they would want it to be clarified. Oh, he doesn't specifically say Title 10, Title 30. They would want it clarified. And so we're going forward with the same mentality that we've always gone forward. I am not here to be the easy button for any weak-kneed, squishy politician. If they're not willing to do the right thing without the cover of the federal government, without somebody telling them it's okay, you're a good boy, it's okay, I don't want them. I want to win them over, or I want to remove them from office. Mm. And that's the way we do it. So if they're not principled enough to do it without Pete's letter, and they decide to come on board and do it once we do get Pete's letter, we'll welcome them to the party, and then we'll kick them right out afterwards when we're done, and we'll mm-hmm. hang their scalp on the barn.
So how's the fight going in Montana? Because you've been working on this tirelessly, David. It's why we've done so many remote interviews. Yeah. It's why we haven't had you on a couple episodes. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so it's, got on the ground 2 weeks ago. We had a big list of people. We did not know where they're going to stand. There's a huge churn in the Montana legislature, about almost 30% is brand new
it's
people.
Huge.
Wow.
So we just don't know where they're at. Never faced the bill before. If you're talking to a legislator about this bill, one of the things for people to understand is it does deal with issues that legislators just don't deal with, right? You're talking about two different titles of federal code. They don't look at Montana code other than when they're writing a bill in that section, right? So right. They'll read the section that they're trying to change. They'll say, hey, I want to do this thing with barbershops. And so they'll look up the barbershop section and they'll read it and be like, oh, okay, that's what that means. And they'll change the thing that they want. It's very rare to get a legislator that has a grasp on those issues. So you have a long ways to go with a very narrow time frame to get them up to speed so that they can navigate the issue and understand it. But in short, really what I see coalescing in Montana is a coalition of the constitutional Republican conservatives with progressive Democrats and the Indian Caucus. That's kind of the group we're pulling together to make this whole thing happen. Yeah. And it looks like if we get by getting out of committee here soon, get to the floor, we got a pathway to the floor by one or two votes.
And you can swing those two votes?
Yeah. That's what we're working on.
Heck,
I mean the margin of error is larger than two votes, but that's what we're shooting for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's just 100 people, man. It's and moving very quickly.
Yeah.
So
it does make the work in Montana easy when you've got a sponsor like Lee Deming.
Yes.
The man is he is brilliant when it comes to constitutional principles, and the story is just so wholesome about mm-hmm. Your friend Liam and mm-hmm. how he introduced it to Lee. But Lee is I've never seen a legislator work as hard on a bill as he has on this one. Oh,
yeah. And passionate. Passionate, man. The guy, he cares deeply. You could tell when he talks about it. So that's a huge asset on our side. We're going to crush the committee tomorrow.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm so glad to hear that. If we can rally people to do anything in that effort, you know, to try to help with that, what can people do? What can people do?
Hey, phone banking is probably the most important thing. We don't want everybody to come to Helena, pack the room. Obviously, if you want to come and testify, you're welcome. Yeah. I think the room is big enough for about 12 people. It's not a large room, but you can stand in the hall and wait, and you can also remote in. If you have really good testimony that's germane to the bill and you can stay focused on the topics of the bill, we'd invite you to testify. Yeah. But the most important thing is go to defendtheguard.us/phonebank and sign up to spend 15 minutes. 30 minutes, an hour, and just call the members of the committee and let them know you support the bill and you expect them to also. Don't ask them to support it. Tell them you expect them to. And for one reason, because it protects Montana National Guardsmen. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole point of the bill. And so when we start talking about Title 10, Title 32, it really dilutes the whole argument. The argument is this: the militia belongs to the states and to the federal government. And when the federal government comes a knocking, they have to follow certain rules to take them. And that's all we want people to say in whatever passionate way they can say it, whatever comes from their heart. Mm-hmm. But number two, if you have the ability, fighting these fights is not cheap. I mean, the $75, is that how much I paid you?
Yeah.
$75? Yeah. to pay people to be there in the Capitol building, knocking doors, pressing the flesh, is peanuts compared to what it costs to send emails to the organization to keep our director of field operations fully engaged. So we are a small dollar donor organization. We thrive on $5, $10, $15, and $20 monthly donations from our supporters. And I don't take a paycheck. I do this as a hobby. I do this as a passion. I pay for my own travel. I've got two paid people. One is a communications director in Florida and one is Diego in Texas. Other than that, we are all veteran led and volunteer led. And, so phone bank, chip in a couple bucks if you can. And then the last thing I would say is to just be informed. Pay attention, see what's going on, and join the movement. If you go on our website and sign our little petition, it says enlist in the movement, kind of a play on words for the military. You'll start getting our emails, and there's call to actions in every email that we send out. And I think our content, if Hunter, if you're listening, I'm going to say it's a solid A-. I think there's room for improvement. I'm going to need you to step up your game. But Hunter is one of the editors and writers at the Libertarian Institute and antiwar.com. He works with the great Scott Horton. Puts out killer content, and I don't know. I only surround myself with the best, and we have a couple advisors that are from the Ron Paul era, that were Ron Paul's bodyguards, and
awesome.
And then Sean, Diego, and myself, we go around the country and teach activists how to do what we do, and we teach leadership schools. So if you want to put a leadership school on, go to bringourtroopshome.us/ click on the button that says. School.
We'll put the link in the show notes. How about that?
and I want to echo that too. I've been involved in quite a few different grassroots organizations, and I've never seen a group with the kind of passion and focus and drive. The volunteer output is frankly amazing.
It's crazy.
Like it's so incredible, and you could see the passion in what they're doing. And I've been shocked by what they're able to accomplish.
That's awesome.
That's why it's growing. It's grassroots. There is no AstroTurf here. There is no big funder. The Koch brothers aren't coming in and saving us with money. Not, CVA, we love you guys. But I don't have that kind of juice.
Yeah.
Right? We are literally, we're funded by mom and pops.
Well, not to mention what you're up against. I mean, the word on the street is you've got generals taking legislators around in helicopters.
It's a rumor.
It's a real thing.
Is that a real thing?
Oh, yeah. I watched the vans. Yeah.
I think we have pictures.
Yeah.
What is that about? I mean, are they allowed to do that?
So there is a, I'm gonna make it a short story as much as I can. But so it is normal for legislators to take tours of the local National Guard facilities in state administration. State administration is usually a committee that's about how you administer things, right? How you deal with code relating to in-state issues. That is where the bill usually goes. But this time, for the very first time, as far as we know, and we look back. For the very first time, he's giving you a beer, brother.
Thanks, man. Appreciate
that. Okay. I'm open it for him.
All right, there you go.
Carry on.
We got the bill. They invited the Energy, Technology, and Federal Affairs Committee for the very first time this year.
Why are we in that committee? I'm just curious.
Better committee. Well, also federal affairs, right? It makes sense, right? Yep. It's compatible with the bill, and you know the I mean, the logistics just worked way better.
So let me just make sure I understand that. This bill has been heard in a different committee in years past, and this year you're in a better, more favorable committee.
Yeah, and then they did a special tour for the first time this Monday, the Monday before the bill hearing.
A special tour for the non-administration committee.
Yeah.
To just go check out the facilities.
They've never offered it to the Senate Energy Committee. They've never offered it to anybody else, just state administration.
So they loaded them up on GSA government-owned vans, right? Mm-hmm. Drove them from the Capitol out to the Armory, put them on helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters, mm-hmm. and flew them around with popsicles. look at all the cool things we do, and this all goes away if you pass that pesky bill.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, they're now calling it a patriotic but misguided bill.
Oh.
Yes.
So, wow.
Yeah.
We appreciate it, but it's just not right.
But they do like this. They're like patriotic and misguided. Oh, you know, they're like, yuck, yuck.
Yeah,
you know?
Those silly goofballs.
Silly, so simple.
You know, that was the funny thing. I was having a conversation with somebody. He's like, well, I'll defund the Guard. And I was like, do you really think Lee Deming wants to defund the Guard? Is that what you think? You think he wants the National Guard not to exist or not to have what they need? And they're like, oh, you know, I never thought of that before. And I was like, yeah, you know, but that's how these conversations go. I mean, that's part of the pervasiveness, right? I mean, you get an adjutant general who's walking the hall saying, you know, I'd like to meet you. And they got all the badges and all that stuff. And, you know, legislators were like, oh, well, that's the expert in the area.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what that person's telling me.
But,
so.
But do you think that would actually even happen, too, again, with like the Trump administration, with like, you know, Pete Hegseth kind of rejuvenating the Department of Defense? Like, is that even likely to happen?
I think we'd be dishonest if we didn't say it's a legitimate threat. But I think we've got the ammunition to prove that it's not practical. Right. You just cannot defund the National Guard. There's all kinds of statutory laws. There's the Anti-Impoundment Act, where if Congress has appropriated funds, you have to use the funds for, as the general in Arizona said, to do the thing that the thing says. Thanks, Joe Biden.
That is, it was brilliant. So eloquent.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The stars do not equal IQ.
And it appears to me that the argument is just a torturous definition of readiness. So you take readiness. You would guess, if you're just a regular person, you say readiness is the capability and willingness to do the thing that you said you would do.
Yeah.
Right? And they say readiness is now doing whatever we tell you to do.
Right.
And that's the justification.
And being ready to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and you know, this torturous definition just, you know, goes by most people because legislators, they're focused in their policy issue areas. They don't know anything about Title 32 or what the National Guard issue. So they just create that association. They're like, oh, well, the authority figure's telling me this. They're an expert in the area, which is very common for legislators because they're not specialists. They have 90 days to pass, like, to decide 1,000 bills. Right. Right. They have very little time to make these decisions. So, cutting through that and like showing what the real truth of this thing is possible. It's just very difficult. And you know, all the grassroots activists are making that a reality. I mean, they're texting people every day saying, this is the truth about the bill and this is where it is. And I'm a veteran. And this is where it's at. Second to that, they have a natural advantage in that they can go out and talk of the bill in uniform and do all that kind of stuff. Well, regular National Guards members, regular people who are just serving their country, they can't. The reason why is if they do, that general is going to ruin their career.
Mm.
Right? So we've accumulated 3 letters of anonymous National Guard members here in Montana, and I've released them on my Substack. I probably shouldn't have put in the Human Reaction Substack, but I was a little bit worried to be charged a little bit. So
we'll cross post.
so that we could get the word out about these guys, you know, keeping their identity anonymous, and we'll be introducing that in the committee as testimony, because those guys couldn't show up.
But that's why it's important that we find people like Lieutenant Colonel Darren Gobb, right? He's the head of the Montana Freedom
Caucus. Yep.
He retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. He knows about appropriations. He knows about procurement. He knows about the BRAC list, which is the Base Realignment and Closure Program. He knows how a guard unit could possibly be defunded. And he is on the record as saying that you can't do it for what you're saying. You can't do it because a state were to have a policy put in place that would keep the National Guard from going and fighting in war in the Congo. Mm-hmm. And so Darren Gobb's a powerful voice. So when veterans that are current serving today can't testify, guys like Darren Gobb, guys like myself, people like Tulsi Gabbard, who supports the bill, we have an obligation to those that are in uniform. And I'd like to compare it to after World War I, the American Legion was created. And the American Legion veterans from World War I went to bat, and they said, we will take care of the veterans from World War II. And when the veterans from World War II came home, they joined the American Legion. They said, we will take care of the veterans that come home from the next war and the next war and the next war. And that's the way this veteran brotherhood, this fraternity works. I did not stop my oath when they medically retired me. Hmm. My 5th general order as a Marine and a soldier says that I will not quit my post until I'm properly relieved. No one's relieved me yet. So I get to still stand fast and defend the Constitution. And I do it for the people in uniform that can't speak up. Because if shit hits the fan, they're going to be the ones that are going to be over there standing up for us. Mm. And I just want to make sure we do it with the proper authority.
Yeah. And one of the arguments I've been using with particularly legal-minded legislators, like lawyers and stuff like that, is, you know, it's true. The National Guard Bureau might try. But then we're going to have a lawsuit about it. And they now have to defend that torturous definition of readiness in a court with an adversarial process that isn't them having all the authority coming down and trying to intimidate and confuse legislators. And in that case, can you imagine a strict constructionist Supreme Court like our current one deciding any other way than that the law says what the law says? Right. I mean, it's so remote. It's like saying, yeah, could it be 60 degrees in January? Yeah, but probably not. You know, like that's probably not going to happen. And, yeah. And for all kinds of really good reasons. There's also the Administrative Procedures Act. There's also court case history that suggests if the federal government makes a promise like this to the states with return benefits to the federal government, as we have in Title 32, that there's a case for a contract, that this is an implicit contract between the states and the federal government, and therefore the states have a case. So we got standing, we have injury, we have all the things that build a real case. So in that, we should have that argument. And it's an important argument. I would love
it. We want that. Yeah. We want that argument. The passing defend the guard somewhere. Some state's going to be first. And the general in Arizona last week testified. He goes, we can't be the first. I mean, wagged his finger at the committee. We can't be the first to do this. Well, the first gets all the ammunition. Whoever's first gets to go, and they'll be the ones going to the Supreme Court. And this will, you're right. The makeup of the court right now, we have zero doubt that they would uphold defend the guard. And in fact, we're so confident in it. You even look back to the Supreme Court in the 1990s, which was much less conservative than it is now, much less of an originalist court. This concept of the states interposing between the federal government and their militia went before the Supreme Court in a case called Perpich v. Department of Defense. And Justice John Paul Stevens wrote the majority opinion. It wasn't majority. I take it back. The unanimous opinion. It was 9-0 that states could not object to the federal government taking their National Guard overseas for training. And the reason that the Supreme Court said that is because in Title 10, it specifically says training. You can't object to training because it's something the Guard has to do to maintain their readiness.
It's in Title 32. It's like it's right there. Right? 32 so it's and very 10. Clear Both. That yep. It's a violation.
Yep. And then now the National Guard Bureau and all the generals, they read that says the states can't interpose and interject. But they don't read that last part of the sentence for overseas training.
Yeah.
And so they use that as their hat to hang on. And we were like, please hang your hat on that, because if we go before any district court, it would get shut down right there. It would never make it to the Supreme Court. We want the battle at the Supreme Court. We've got a former solicitor general from the state of Idaho that's signed on to appeal. He's like, I want to be involved in this if it goes to the next level. Mm. We've got constitutional attorneys around the country that are salivating at the opportunity to defend this before court. And, you know, you take it on the United States government and the Department of Defense, it's daunting. Mm-hmm. But when you've got the law and you've got ethics and you've got moral and you've got the Constitution, bring on the giants.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You said Pete Hegseth left Japan to come back and fire hundreds of generals. Yeah. Are there any of those within the National Guard hierarchy that are on the chopping block potentially? Do you know yet?
I'll tell you the exact answer you would get from Pete if he was sitting in this room. No. Because the National Guard generals are Title 32 soldiers. He has no purview over them whatsoever.
So those are governors' purview.
They're governors, correct. But here's the thing. This is where the law gets so intricate and so just nerdy. Every general wants to get promoted. Every officer wants to get promoted. Every soldier wants to get promoted. If you're an officer, you have to get promoted twice. Every time you advance a rank, you have to go through your state board and get recognized by your state to advance. And then you have to go to the FedRec or the Federal Recognition Board. Pete and the Department of Defense set the criteria for the FedRec. So if a general wants to get that second star, he can make it a criteria. Well, if you testified against defend the guard, it's a no-go. So he can set the parameters that would limit a one-star general, which in the general world, they're looked at like privates. You know, that nobody really cares about a one-star general. Mm. So they show up in the legislature with that one star, but that's the only place where it really means anything. It's that second and third star that means something. Mm. The second star means you're going to get $1 million a year job when you retire. A third star means it's a multi-million-dollar-a-year job. And so Pete could control that. He can't fire them, though. The only way he could fire a general from the National Guard would be if he were to activate that general under one of the Title 10 purposes and then shit-can him.
Oh.
So,
interesting.
I guess in theory he could.
Little backdoor effort
right,
there.
Right.
Interesting.
I'm sorry. When you're talking to military guys,
you don't talk about the backdoor.
We don't say backdoor. No.
side door.
We're only gay for the state when we're deployed.
fair.
Sorry, John.
What are some of the other arguments you can use with the legislators? I mean, a lot of people don't think about Montana as being a border state, but it is, and we seem to have a problem with drug flow over our border. Is that something that could be effective with legislators who are worried about border security?
Well, and frankly, that's one of our best cases for the Indian Caucus, who is a, it's a, think of the Indian Caucus like a subgroup of legislators that band together because they have a common identity, in this case, being Native American. And, you know, their number one concern is fentanyl.
Yeah.
Right. And they're saying, and they have a very high service rate. So they're saying our National Guard's all over the place. They should be protecting us from fentanyl coming from Mexico and from Canada. And that case is working very well. And, you know, that support is critical. Because we have such a soft middle when it comes to both the Republicans and the Democrats. We've got to pull together this coalition. That case, I think, is compelling, too, for your average low-income American, right? I mean, like,
for sure.
I've actually, several legislators have said, yeah, border crisis, will this keep us from being able to defend our borders? It's like, yeah, that's the kind of what it's for. Yeah. So,
for sure.
And the other one is, there was, right now, perhaps, it's not clear, but from 2022 to sometime in 2024, or perhaps even right now, Montana's National Guard was deployed to Syria.
Hmm.
Syria. Did we ever declare war on Syria?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, no. At the same time, it's so interesting because the AUMF standard, like the status quo here, is not well understood. Like the average person is just like, this is kind of what we do now, you know? But the flaws of that system are kind of subsurface. So the AUMF standard in this case is really interesting because and I'm sure we're going to get into this maybe tomorrow, if you look at what the mission was for sending them to Syria, it was to fight ISIS with the allies of the Kurds, right? At the exact same time that when they're doing that before, up until 2017 and perhaps probably afterwards because they got found out, leaked cable became a New York Times?
New York Times.
Yep. Article. So I'm sure they shut down that program and started a brand new one. Was at the same time that we were defending or trying to fight ISIS with the Kurds, the CIA was running guns using Operation Timber Sycamore to fight Assad. So we literally had our National Guard working contra direction because Assad was also fighting ISIS. Assad was not connected with Al-Qaeda. We were using the 2001 AUMF to fight that was designed to stop Al-Qaeda as a reason to fight ISIS while the CIA was funding our ally fighting ISIS in Syria at the same time. Like you're saying, like we're fighting on different sides.
American dollars shooting American dollars.
Yeah. So this process, and like it, like explaining that to somebody saying like that we literally don't have a mission that is unified across from our intelligence services to our guys on the ground. Why would we want this AUMF standard that can be used so capriciously and arbitrarily so that we're literally fighting our own government's aims and resources overseas?
It's just insane.
Yeah. So like those arguments have worked pretty well. When I can actually get the time to sit down and chat with somebody, man, it is powerful because there's just not much knowledge out there about this.
That's the hardest part is the education part. But with the border specifically, I want to address a couple points. The National Guard exists, like I said, three purposes, right? Repel an invasion, put down an insurrection, enforce the laws of the union. So Ken Paxton, Attorney General of Texas, and Mark Brenovich, Attorney General of Arizona, both declared in opinion, formal written opinion submitted to the governor, that the situation on the southern border constitutes a constitutional invasion. Mm-hmm. The governor at that point, once they have that legal authority, they can rely on Article 4 of the Constitution and say, hey, federal government, you owe us a Republican form of government. You owe us security and safety. And if the federal government doesn't respond, it's the state's duty to provide that for their citizens. Mm-hmm. And so we saw Governor Abbott in Texas sent the National Guard to the border and he fought the Biden administration for 4 years. Mm-hmm. They put up a fence. Biden administration took it back down. Mm-hmm. Governor Katie Hobbs in Arizona, I call her cartel Katie Hobbs, instead of sending the National Guard to the border with long rifles pointing south, she sent the National Guard to the southern border without weapons, without armor, in an administrative duty to expedite immigration and asylum claims to get people into the heartland of America faster. She used the National Guard to aid and abet an invasion. And when we passed the Arizona Senate last year, or maybe it was the year before, I can't remember, we passed Defend the Guard through the Senate. It was going to the House. It was going to end up on her desk within 5 days. She was in Oman. She herself traveled to Oman with her adjutant general and signed a treaty with the Sultan of Oman committing the Arizona National Guard to defend the Omani borders. While we were,
are you kidding me?
I am not kidding you. Again, box of crayons. Only thing to the story that doesn't check out. They don't call it a treaty though; they call it a partnership, because we all know from PBS and public school education in fourth grade that states can't sign treaties, right?
Right.
But she signed a partnership committing the Arizona National Guard to defend the Omani border. While we were debating border security in her home state, Cartel Katie Hobbs, Speaker of the House Ben Toma, then Ben Toma decides he wants to run for Congress. And I told you we're a grassroots organization. We have this barn, a figurative barn, where we hang all the scalps that we take. Ben Toma decides he wants to run for Congress. He killed the bill. Him and Kevin Payne killed the bill in the Arizona House. So do you think we let him run for Congress very peacefully?
I imagine not.
No, we found Abe Hamadeh, who he ran against, and we piled troops behind Abe Hamadeh, and we made Ben Toma Abe's bitch. And Ben Toma now is erased from the public memory. Kevin Payne is no longer in the House. He's now a senator in Arizona. He went into the hearing last week, not even a member of the committee, and drug one of the committee members out into the hall in the middle of the hearing and lambasted him and tried to break him and force him to vote against the bill. We have it on camera. We caught it on the camera.
Wow. And
so that's how bad this is. It's one or two stooges that are just carrying the water for the National Guard Bureau. But back to the border security. The National Guard, they're not. It's like money. Money's fungible, right? If I give you money to pay your rent, does that mean you have more money to buy groceries? It does, right? If the National Guard is deployed overseas from Montana, that means that there is not a National Guard here to defend the border,
yeah, right?
Unless it comes from somewhere else. So it doesn't have that same fungibility as money does. So when we met with, we were in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration, and we got to meet with Tom Homan, border czar,
yeah,
and talked to him about Defend the Guard at length, explained the entire concept of the bill. He hands me his cell phone. He goes, put your number on my phone. He goes, I love this. He goes, I would love to have the full resources of the National Guard to accomplish my mission as the border czar.
Awesome.
And so, yes, with the National Guard not being deployed to overseas wars to Syria or Djibouti, Africa, or where is Jim Risch talking about sending them to right now? I just heard him talking about this. The Sudan. We're going to war in the Sudan. Yeah. There's nothing in Sudan. Have you guys looked? Have you guys watched National Geographic? There's nothing there worth fighting for. There is a cocoa rebellion being fought in the Western Horn of Africa right now. A cocoa rebellion. We've got National Guard troops on the ground fighting for cocoa.
Well,
I'd rather them fight to
look,
stop that.
We have to have our chocolate, right?
Well, we do.
But what happens if we don't have chocolate?
Let's get it from the peaceful nation of Belgium, though. Or Brazil.
Does Belgium grow cocoa?
I don't know.
I don't think they do.
They make lots of chocolate.
I think that's sort of like a finished good.
Oh. I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, probably.
But you're right. We'll get it from Belgium instead.
close your eyes. Read the label. It just
blood
says
cocoa.
Blood cocoa.
Blood cocoa. Oh,
I don't know. Who knows?
It's like a new Nick Cage movie. Cocoa.
But that's always the challenge of empire, right? Is there's always a justification for the next intervention over and over and over again. So.
Yeah. Of all of them, though, chocolate is for sure the worst.
I could buy into it. I could. I like a dark chocolate.
That's true. That's true. But I feel like we could maybe figure out how to peacefully get our chocolate without guarding
it. None of that garbage white chocolate, though. Guard. That stuff is horrible.
It's not actually real chocolate.
It's disgusting. It tastes like plastic.
On the other side of it, guys, if we're going to be doing this for, the empire, I mean, it's better to be cocoa than poppy seeds, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's debatable.
although I hear raw cacao actually has some sort of like crazy, not psychedelic effects, but like people are using it for some sort of mental
Rocket,
effect.
What?
Say more.
Raw cacao. Like cocoa beans.
Really?
Yeah, yeah,
the
for sure.
Effects?
Dude, the hippies will find a way to make a drug out of anything. They figured out how to make chocolate a drug.
I can smoke this bottle.
Right. Joe was one.
I know. I keep tabs on my former people. I go to fish shows occasionally just to make sure I know what they're into.
I knew you from the farmer's market. I knew it.
I cut my dreadlocks off. Yeah.
What's that? Macrame? You weave like wool into baskets? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I wear a, what do they call those? Those woven Mexican sweaters.
Yeah.
I forget what it's
poncho?
Called.
Poncho?
No.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Anyway, I've lost touch, obviously. I've been clean cut for too long.
He said woven sweater. Is there any other kind of sweater?
I don't know.
It's going to come to me as soon as we stop recording.
By definition, it's woven.
Yeah. I suppose you're right. Yeah. I suppose you're right.
So it wouldn't be a human reaction show if we didn't have something to react to.
Oh.
Ah.
Are we going to go there? Or are you
I want to ask one more real question. Okay. And then we're going to go to David's authentic human reaction.
Guys, I got to drive back to Helen tonight.
Fascinating clip. All right. We'll keep it short. I just want to know. So if Defend the Guard passes in one of these states, when it passes, what happens after that?
I retire.
You just hang it up and you're like, job's done.
I've been fighting political battles since the mid-80s.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah. I want to work myself out of a job. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. Bennett nailed it.
Just put you on a fucking goddamn
aircraft carrier.
Not Rushmore.
Not Rushmore.
No, yeah. What happens next is we have 49 other states.
Right.
And the war machine is going to come back strong. And hopefully we've built the organization. I think we pass in one state. This organization grows into something big and powerful that's going to need something a lot smarter than me to run it. And at that point, I'll show up and look pretty for the cameras and let somebody else run the organization. But we will still march on. I'm committed to restoring war powers. I'm a 10th Amendment guy to the core. I believe in decentralizing everything. I don't even keep my Tupperware in the same cabinet at home, right? What if that cabinet caught fire?
Yeah.
Right? So we'll find something to do, but what I really want to do is spend some time with my incredibly patient and loving wife. And last year in the middle of the fight, I lost two labs, my service dog and my old lady, Lexi. So my black lab is Mr. Johnny Cash and my yellow lab is Lexi. And I want to spend some time with my new replacement dogs because they're two chocolate labs and they're dumber than a box of rocks and they don't even know who I am.
Mm-hmm. Are they from Belgium?
They are. Belgian chocolate
yes. Labs.
I hate you so much.
I'm sorry.
Okay. It's well done. Full circle.
Well, I sympathize, man. You're running around the country. You're sacrificing a lot for this movement. And I really appreciate it. And I know our listeners do too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. But I think what we've realized today, though, is that we've been doing it wrong. We've been doing it all wrong. We learned today that there's just more to this than what we've been doing. We've been trying to preach logic. And what we learned today is that the national debate champions, I don't even know where they're from. You knew where they were from.
Towson University,
Towson,
I believe.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure.
Where's that at?
HSBC,
I want to say it's in New Hampshire, Connecticut. It's in the Northeast, I'm pretty sure.
You know sports ball. Where are they from?
Sports ball. Not spelling bee.
I believe it's a historically black college, right? HSBC, right? But they were the first fully, completely African-American national debate champions.
It's in Maryland.
Maryland, thank you. Yeah, I should have known that.
So Bennett, just get the dump button ready, but we're going to watch.
You just got it. You
can't cue it up better than that. This is going to be a live reaction for me. Let's see what's going on. All right, let's go.
University's debate team wins, claiming an historic win. They are the first all-black women's team to win the Cross-Examination Debate Association's national championship. This morning, we have two of the team members here. We have Amina Ruffin and Corey Johnson both here to talk about the major victory. Ladies,
What were their names?
Amina Ruffin and Corey Johnson.
God damn, okay.
Amina Ruffin.
Fire away.
Congratulations. You've made so many people proud in this area. Now we want to pick your brain a little bit as we admire your huge trophy, by the way. That's ridiculous.
It is a huge
trophy. I'm going to ask you first. We'll start with you, Amina. What was the topic, first of all?
The topic was restricting presidential war powers authority.
They say that is always already queer. That's exactly the point. It means that the impact is that it is a case turn to the affirmative because we are saying that queer bodies are not able to survive. That it necessarily means that the body of the is not able to survive.
We got the topic in about July. We started doing our
research. Sees these pains and suffering that he can only envision himself, that he does not see another that he can feel sympathy for or embrace, but rather that otherness gets obliterated.
And we've been supplementing our research throughout the season.
Religion, trauma, enough, the inside the trauma of representation that gentle to the black child, devouring and identifying with the stories and the images of white culture brought up.
Your reaction is everything. So where do you go from there? You know, when you start preparing for a national competition, once you know the topic, what's next?
Well, you do a lot of research.
Arguing it.
I can't tell if it's a debate or a poetry slam.
No, man.
Oh. There's no way anchor ever heard any of this.
I feel like emergency.
We got to get these people to committee tomorrow.
Most of the people get to testify only get 1 minute. Think of how much more material we can deliver. Right? I speak at about 145 words a minute. She's 600.
Yeah.
All gibberish.
Yeah, about five of them are useful, but the other 595 are there.
dude, that's how we get those Democrats. I know it.
That's right? How you got do it.
Yeah. We're fighting in Maryland right now. Oh. You don't think I'm going to use this? You don't think I'm going to use it?
Do it.
We got a charter jet from Maryland. Get them here tomorrow.
Yeah.
That's what's going to win
back
it for you guys.
In Maryland time. Oh,
yep.
Man.
Yep. That's how that's how you break through.
We've been doing it wrong. Look at that. Two million views. It's only two days old, too. Yeah.
Look, there's all sorts of techniques for debate, and this is just a novel technique.
Yeah.
Right?
There you go.
We're learning things. That's, we're evolving.
First of all, I don't know if you can get back to the end of that video. They're actually on the debate stage. I just want to see one last.
Let's see here. Oh, no. That's further back. Further back.
Right there. Okay. Is that a tub of Christmas decorations that she's
totally what's going on there? I was gonna ask, does that have significance
it's
here?
It's like standing desk.
Think I have like Christmas ornaments in a tub just like that in my garage.
I think my parents did in 1991.
Yeah. I am old.
I think she carries her generational trauma in there.
I don't know that could have actually been better played. That was so wonderful. I'm so mad I didn't think of that.
Oh, well. You can have that one for later.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yep.
All right.
On that note, Dan, this has been a lot of fun and a really, really great opportunity to learn more about Defend the Guard. In all seriousness, thank you so much for the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
And to your entire team and to all the volunteers with Defend the Guard, you guys are crushing it. We have nothing but faith in you. We're counting on you to get this done. We know you're going to do it.
It's a lot of pressure.
It's all right. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, I figure like you probably thrive under pressure. Seems like you might.
Maybe. A little bit.
Thank you so much for joining us on Human Reaction.
Me, I appreciate it.
It's been a blast. We'd love to have you back again sometime.
Anytime. It's just a short 12-hour drive from my house.
No problem. We'll do a victory lap here in a few months.
I'll tell you what. I will commit to that. If we pass out of committee and through onto the House for a debate, I'll be back. Mm. Yep.
Awesome.
It's worth it.
All right.
Nice.
Yep. Sounds like a deal.
Right on.
There's some people that testified on the House floor last time that I have a bone to pick with.
Yeah, ooh. So, yeah. All right.
Cheers.
Sounds good.
Thanks, everybody.
Cheers, brother.
We'll see you in the next one. Thanks for tuning in to Human Reaction. Please be sure to like, follow, subscribe, and give us a review on your podcast platform of choice. And if you want to become a member and support the show financially, check out humanreactionpod.com. And remember, she carries her generational trauma in there.
I don't know that could have actually been better played.